Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, welcome along to Unbelievable, the show that aims to get Christians and non-Christians thinking every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Briley. I'll be your host for the next hour and a half. This programme, part of Faith Explored, helping you to think through your faith every Saturday afternoon. But if you want to specifically catch up on more programmes, discussions on Unbelievable, why not visit the webpage of the show? That's premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. And I'll be introducing my guests in just a moment's time. We've got a great discussion coming up for you on the existence of God, something we do a lot on this show, but taking it from a slightly different perspective today. Callum Miller and James Croft are going to be my guests on today's programme. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. And don't forget that if you were or weren't able to attend Unbelievable, the conference 2014 in July, that we're making it all available via DVD and audio MP3 CD. If you're interested in ordering a copy of that, some 13 hours or more of audio and video from the conference with loads of great speakers this year, answering all kinds of issues around Christianity, faith, evidence for God and so on. Do check out the website where you can do that as well. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. And of course, later on today, you can hear the profile interview that comes up straight after Unbelievable between 4 and 5. We'll be hearing from another significant Christian in some area of leadership in arts, culture, politics, media, science, you name it really. But what's going on in today's show? Well, let me introduce my guests for today as we ask, is God the best explanation for life, the universe, and pretty much everything?
You're unbelievable.
Well, I'm joined today by Callum Miller. He's a young apologist and philosopher. Also, James Croft. I'll give him his long title, Ethical Culture Leader in Training at the Ethical Society of St. Louis in Missouri. He'll explain more about that in a moment's time. But he's our atheist. Callum is our Christian on today's discussion. And, well, Callum's contention is that in many respects, the universe and many aspects of life are what we would expect to see on a theistic worldview, a worldview in which there is a God, but conversely, not what we would expect to see on an atheistic worldview. So we're going to be talking about whether the intelligibility of the universe by scientific principles, whether our apparent access to moral beliefs and knowledge indicates that the best explanation is God in the end. Something Callum generally labels this argument as the argument from induction. So we're going to get into this. We're going to try and keep it at a level where everyone can engage as well. So welcome, gentlemen, both to today's programme. Let's start with you, Callum. It's been about a year, I think, since you were on the programme last, just over, talking about the resurrection, I think, with Chris Halk, the probability, at least, involved in the resurrection. It was a really interesting programme, that. But for those who maybe are not familiar with you, you're actually a training in sort of final year or so of being a medic, aren't you?
Yeah, so I've just started my final year of medicine. So my final exams are this January coming up. Quite a lot of hard work being done on that at the moment. But I try to do as much philosophy and other stuff as I can. So.
This is a kind of a passion that developed sort of after you'd begun your degree in medicine, isn't it?
I think it was already there beforehand, but I wasn't really sure what to apply for when I applied to university. And then kind of on a whim...
So you went the easy route of medicine, obviously.
Well, kind of on a whim, my biology teacher just said, apply for medicine. You can apply for philosophy if you don't get in. And so I did, and then I got in, and it kind of just went from there.
You're a bright spark, because this was Oxford University, where you've been training. But that's given you the opportunity to pursue the philosophy interest under some pretty significant characters like Richard Swinburne, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's one of the real privileges that I've had that's come from being in Oxford, is that they're very open to people doing interdisciplinary things and engaging in other subjects. So like you say, Richard Swinburne, I think partly because he was in retirement, was happy to give some of his time to mentor me and do some philosophy work with me as well. So I've been really kind of lucky to have that.
I know that you were involved in helping to host a sort of conference in Oxford that took place near the time of Unbelievable, the conference, and you had people like Tim McGrew over for that as well. Do you want to just give us a flavour of what you were doing there?
Yeah, so that was kind of similar to the radio show we did last year on the probability of the resurrection, and that was the theme of the conference. So we had people like Richard Swinburne and Timothy McGrew and David Glass, who I think has been on the show as well. A philosopher called John DePoe from the States and I hosted this conference where we basically both gave an introduction to the probability of the resurrection and the issues involved, and then there were a few presentations and discussions about some of the relevant probabilities, and it in the end got quite technical and academic, which is partly what we wanted. So it was really good, and hopefully will lead to further work.
Yeah, okay, exciting stuff anyway. And you're trying to make that available as well, I understand.
We're working on putting the audio and video together and hopefully should be able to dissipate it more.
Well, we'll make sure people on the Unbelievable wavelength know about that when it's available. But great to have you in. You're also involved, I know, in the UK Apologetics Facebook page, that kind of thing, the website there and so on. Lots of exciting things going on for you. James, thank you for joining us again. Again, no stranger to this programme either. You've been on a few times over the years. And it's nice when you're in the UK to get you in person, as it were, because you're more or less based out in the US all of the time these days, aren't you?
Yes, I moved out there about 7 years ago now, and so it's a great privilege to be able to come back occasionally and visit you, Justin.
Well,
which is the main reason, of course. I come back.
Would you come back to the UK?
Quite right.
But you're actually, at the time of recording, over for a humanist congress going on in Oxford. But you yourself are very much involved in the sort of pastoral side of the humanist movement. Explain this title. You were, last time I spoke to you, involved with the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard. Now you're the ethical culture leader in training at the Ethical Society of St. Louis in Missouri.
Yes, it's a very strange title, but essentially what ethical culture societies are humanist congregations. So they're very similar in some terms of social function and what they do to congregations of other religions, and this one is just one of about 24, I think, remaining humanist congregations that are part of this movement of humanist congregations that started in New York and spread out across America and even in other countries as well when the founder was going around sort of evangelizing his particular version of humanism. And I find it a fascinating thing because I've always wanted to engage people in discussions of the big questions of life. Why are we here? How should we treat each other? What on earth is going on? And by doing this, instead of going into academic philosophy, which is another potential route, I can talk to the culture about the big questions that I'm really interested in a more direct way. And it really appeals to me. So I moved out to St. Louis, where they have the biggest ethical culture society. It's a congregation of about 350 regularly attending members. And we have our own building. It's a beautiful building. Looks like a sort of witch's hat with a big spire in the middle of our main meeting hall. And we have Sunday meetings and educational programs. And it's very similar to a church in terms of...
Well, I was going to say, the Sunday Assembly weren't the first people to think up this idea, were they? And it would be a fascinating program to talk about that at some point. I'm sure we will at some point.
I would so love to do that.
Yeah, it would be great. You're the nearest thing to an atheist vicar, basically.
Yeah.
So it's good to have you on today on the programme. You've got, obviously, though, a strong interest in all the aspects of the discussions going on, not only ethical and social and cultural, but also some of these somewhat more, if you like, philosophical debates. And so thank you for being up, for just coming in and taking on something when you said you were available. I thought, great. Let's see what we can see if we can stump James with something on today's
program. I'm really looking forward to it because I am a... you know, my training is mainly in philosophy. That's what my doctorate is essentially. Exactly. And particularly epistemology. So I'm very interested in the epistemic aspects of these arguments.
Well, you're another bright cookie. So we've got a real match of minds today on the programme. Hope you enjoy it today. And of course, if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on today's programme, you can email in. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Feel free to access us via Facebook and Twitter at UnbelievableJB. If you want to follow the programme, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is the Facebook address. All those links and more, links to both my guests' blogs and so on, from the Unbelievable website with today's programme. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, maybe the best place to start is with you, Callum, just maybe giving us a thumbnail sketch of this argument. We're not going to be able to do this in the depth it deserves, even in the course of an hour-long discussion. But do you want to just kind of take us through some of the basics of this, what this so-called argument from induction is, and why you believe, in the end, it's more rational, on the basis of what we see, to believe we are the product of a god, that, you know, some kind of purpose, than not?
Yeah, sure, thanks. So I think one useful way to think about it is to think about, just very briefly, what evidence for something is in general. And when we think about evidence for a theory, in this case, the theory will be that God exists. We want to explain some features of the world. We look for things which... kind of for features of the world, observations which are surprising if the theory isn't true, but which aren't that surprising if the theory is true.
Okay.
So, for example, if we take like a detective crime scene kind of case, my finding Harry's fingerprints on a gun is very unsurprising if Harry used the gun.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be very surprising to find his fingerprints on the gun if he didn't use it or wasn't involved with it. And so finding his fingerprints on the gun, that observation is evidence that Harry did it.
Sure.
And so that's broadly how evidence kind of works for theories. Now, in this case, we want to see, you know, the theory that God exists. Does this have any evidence supporting it?
Mm.
And if we want to do that, then it's worth looking at features of the world which would be surprising if God didn't exist, but would be less surprising if God did exist.
Hmm.
And there are a number of arguments like this. And so a lot of people who say, who point to features of the world and say, this is strange, this is mysterious, but God can explain it. That's what they're trying to do. So there are a number of arguments that work this way. But one of the particular pieces of evidence that I've been thinking about and we'll discuss today is the observation that the world exhibits a real kind of regularity, and that there are really kind of basic laws to it, that science works, that we can understand the world. For all we know, the universe could have been chaotic. There might not have been any laws to it at all.
Yeah.
And we might not have been able to do science. It might have been just complete chaos.
I mean, I've heard of some philosophers and theologians have talked about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, that we live in this world which seems to be so open to this very fertile way of describing the world, physics, with these beautiful symmetrical mathematical laws. But there's no kind of particular reason why it should have been this way, unless we do go down the route of some kind of design, I suppose.
Yeah, and so I think one nice quote that illustrates it. This is from Paul Davis, who's a physicist, and he's not a Christian, he's a deist. He's kind of sympathetic to kind of some kind of theological claims, but he's not kind of a full-blown theist or anything like that. He puts it this way. People take it for granted that the physical world is both ordered and intelligible. The underlying order in nature, the laws of physics, is simply accepted as given, as brute fact. Nobody asks where the laws come from. At least they don't in polite company. However, even the most atheistic scientist accepts as an act of faith the existence of a law-like order in nature that is at least in part comprehensible to us. So science can proceed only if the scientist adopts an essentially theological worldview.
Yeah, it's kind of a big claim to make, and one that will rile a few non-believing scientists, obviously, but
sure.
But that kind of sums up the essence of it.
So that's the gist of it. That this kind of regularity would be somewhat surprising if God didn't exist. But if God did exist, then we have good reason to expect that the universe would be this way. And so it would count as evidence. It might not necessarily be conclusive or prove God all by itself, but it would at least kind of support theism in some way.
And is this distinct from the very well-known argument from the fine-tuning of the universe, which is that we see all these, you know, fine-tuned aspects of the nature of the universe, which had to be just so in order for life to have been possible in the first place and so on? Is this slightly distinct from that argument?
Yeah, and so one of the neat things about thinking about evidence this way is that you can have evidence that accumulates and that can act, pieces of evidence that can act together to increase the probability of theism or kind of give us more support for theism. And so we could say, okay, the order of the universe supports theism a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, given that order, there are many ways that the universe could be ordered. There are many possible laws of nature. Even if there are laws of nature, the laws of nature could have been such that life wouldn't be possible. And I think that's what people who advocate the fine-tuning argument are getting at. They're saying, even if we say there are laws of nature, so many configurations or permutations or kind of possibilities of the laws don't permit life because the constants in the laws of physics are just incompatible with life. It's quite technical, but that's kind of the gist of it. Only a small set of those laws permit life. Sure. And so in that way, you can kind of add the pieces of evidence together and have a stronger case.
So it's related, obviously, and part of a, as you say, a cumulative case, let's say. Well, that's great. It's given us a kind of an idea for where you're coming from with this argument. And we might want to develop it as well as we go along in terms of what you say about the other aspects of our experience, like moral knowledge and so on, also point in a similar direction. James, very much, guys, treat this as a to and fro between yourself, ask questions and so on as we go along. But you've probably come across arguments of a similar nature over the years. Are you the kind of person who does kind of approach this as a kind of like, I've made a rational decision that there isn't a God, and that's because I've weighed up the evidence to and for, and I've come to the decision that there isn't one on the balance of the evidence? Or because my suspicion is that most atheists don't go through quite that logical process before they call themselves an atheist, if you know what I mean.
I don't know about most atheists. I can certainly say for myself that that's how I think about my own beliefs.
Okay.
Right? I think about them as the result of consideration of the question and weighing up what I take to be the evidence and coming to the conclusion that the evidence is not sufficient to support the assertion of theism.
Yeah.
So I would say that that's how I come up with it. And yes, I've come against these sorts of arguments before. I think they're interesting arguments. I think they're worth discussing. I don't think they're, on the face of it, totally ridiculous. I do think that they rely on some false premises. I think we've already got enough almost to spend a whole program unpacking the premises that have just been outlined. So, for example, in the quote that you just gave, Callum, the person you were quoting said that scientists accept as an act of faith the law-like regularity of nature, without which they couldn't do their work. I think this is flatly false. I think that our ability to construct models which order our experience, and I'm stating that quite carefully because I think that that's what's actually happening. We construct models which bring order to our experience. We do not discover order in the universe. We construct models which bring order to our experience. That does not speak to a faith in the inherent intelligibility and orderedness of the universe. Scientists can proceed in their work without assuming at any point that the universe is inherently ordered or intelligible. And indeed, it seems to me very clear that the universe has many aspects to it that are very far from obviously intelligible. Many of the models that we have to create to try and make sense of our experience are exceptionally complex
and counterintuitive
and very far from the normal processes that most of us engage in everyday thinking. Indeed, it's the case that only a tiny fraction of the world's population could ever engage in the sort of discussion that we're engaging in today. So it doesn't seem to me that that there is any necessary assumption for the process of science to go on that the universe is intelligible, nor does it seem to me entirely clear that the universe is all that intelligible. It seems to me that to make the small progress we have made as a species in understanding our experience has taken millennia of struggle. And that speaks to me to a basic difficulty in understanding our experience.
Yeah. Callum, any response on that?
Sure. So I promise after this I'll do my best not to quote any more. But James, you mentioned kind of the Paul Davis quote that I spoke about, and I just wanted to read this next one, which is also from Paul Davis, which speaks. I just thought it fitted so perfectly what you said. He doesn't even argue, but it just says, "It has become fashionable in some circles to argue that science is ultimately a sham, that we scientists read order into nature, not out of nature, and that the laws of physics are our laws, not nature's. I believe this is arrant nonsense. You'd be hard-pressed to convince a physicist that Newton's inverse square law of gravitation is purely a cultural concoction."
That's astonishing. That is purely an assertion, as you say, right? And it's not a particularly civil assertion.
Arrant nonsense.
But it seems that the decision to use a so-called law of Newton's as an example to support that case is very unwise, because we know the so-called laws discovered in quotes by Newton to be false. They are precisely constructions of Newton's mind used to explain certain aspects of our experience which break down. Given other aspects of our experience, they are not truths.
Do you mean
Newton's
at the quantum
laws
level these
are
laws,
false?
Yes, laws
not
break
even
down.
Just at the quantum level. They break down quite quickly over large scales of distance as well. So it seems to me that Newton's laws are a very good example which demonstrate that what we call scientific laws are useful epistemic tools constructed by human beings to order our experience.
So you go directly against that quote by Paul Davies there, to say, yes, we do read into nature,
yes,
our kind of construct. We don't read off nature, a set of, as it were, stuff that's out there to be discovered, this kind of world of laws and principles and so on, which...
So let me clarify this, because this could get very difficult very quickly. I am not making any ontological claim at all. I am actually saying it is better for us to understand the process of science as a constructive process than as a process of discovery. It makes more sense of what happens when we do science to think of it that way than to think of us as discovering laws in nature. That, it gets quite technical. I am what's called in philosophy an irrealist or a pluralist. I don't think that the way of thinking about our experience as discovering laws of nature or truths about reality is a particularly fruitful way of thinking. We try and understand our experience by constructing models which help us understand it.
Okay, James just then fundamentally disagrees that we are discovering these laws of nature in that sense then.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I probably should have clarified that I didn't intend to kind of involve myself in Paul Davis's kind of belligerence there. I just thought it was kind of appropriate because I saw the quote and it was written to you.
Yes.
But in terms of what I'd say, I think James is partially correct in that when we think about kind of the more esoteric parts of science, when we think about quantum mechanics and things like that, even many scientists will be anti-realists, which is kind of a skepticism that we're actually getting at kind of objective truths here. Mm. Certainly I agree. And James is obviously right about Newton's laws breaking down at particular levels. Mm. But I think I'd kind of what I'm getting at is not necessarily that science is, you know, absolutely and universally kind of accurate, but even kind of more basic things which we kind of use scientific reasoning for, but which don't always strike us as scientific truths. So, for example, the sun will rise tomorrow. Mm. Most of us believe that. This isn't kind of a far-fetched scientific theory. This is just kind of a common sense inference from our observations. And yet it seems to me that the argument could go even just based on things like that. Most of us take for granted that the sun will rise tomorrow, and we think this is a relatively kind of reasonable thing to believe. But this would just be one example of the general argument. But you might say something like, well, on atheism, we have no reason to expect that regularity, for we know the sun could just fail to rise tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But on theism, we can expect that kind of regularity because God set it in place and so on. Mm-hmm. That's just one example, and you know, you need to add in a lot more for the whole argument. But that would be kind of how it works, that even these common sense daily inferences require some kind of regularity to the world. So I don't have to base my case on kind of the absolute success and accuracy of really complicated parts of science. It's these basic things.
But when you say there's this regularity, whether we're atheist or Christian or theist, we all observe this regularity taking place in the universe. We see the sun rising every day. We can measure its orbit around the Earth and so on via science and everything else. So I guess the question then is, Callum, well, why does the presence of a God in the background make that more reasonable than if there is no God? We're all observing the same thing. What's the difference? Why would that suggest that a theistic worldview is more reasonable to hold than an atheistic worldview?
Yeah, and so I think this is one of the problems that people often kind of make when they give apologetic arguments. They point to something about the world that's puzzling or surprising, and then assume because it's surprising given atheism that theism does a much better job of explaining it and therefore is good evidence for theism. And I think a lot of times apologists are mistaken when they argue like that, because even though the thing is surprising, theism doesn't give us any more reason to expect it, and so it doesn't work as an argument. But in this case, I think there is kind of something very interesting about how theism works as a theory. And how it might give us reason to expect a more regular universe. And I think one of the most powerful reasons here is to do with moral responsibility.
Okay.
And the idea there is that if I'm going to affect another person in the world, if I want to poison James, for example, I don't. he'll probably be skeptical now. But if I want to poison James, I need to know about poisons in the world. I need to know how kind of poisonous mushrooms work or red berries and things like that. And if I'm going to have knowledge about how to poison James, there needs to be a kind of regularity in the world. It needs to be the case that in general, red berries are poisonous or things like that. If I have no idea about which things are poisonous or which things will be helpful to James, I can't really affect him morally. I can't really have much moral responsibility over him.
Okay.
If I have no idea how my actions are going to play out in the world, then I can't really choose whether to harm someone or to help them. But it seems that moral responsibility is a relatively good thing that God might want to bring into the world if he's an all good agent. And so if God wants that moral responsibility, which I think a God would want, it makes sense that the universe should have some kind of regularity to allow for that kind of moral interaction.
Okay.
And so that's, I think, one of the reasons.
Yeah.
There are others, but
Let's keep on with that, and we're just getting towards the end of part one already. It flies by, doesn't it? And
wow.
And we'll let James come straight back in when we regroup to continue discussing this, because he's looking quizzical, interested, and ready to respond in just a moment's time. We're talking about whether God is the best explanation for life, the universe, the regularities we see in nature, and so on. Is it less likely that we would see those things on an atheistic worldview? Well, that's the contention that Callum has, and he's in conversation today with James Croft, our atheist guest on the programme. You're listening to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and we will be back in just a moment's time as we continue to plot our way through this interesting argument from induction that Callum Miller, our apologist, is bringing to the fore today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Yes, welcome back to the programme. If you want to find us online, we're at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find lots of past programmes there, links to the Unbelievable DVD and audio CD. I'm Justin Brierley, and your host for today's programme here as part of the Faith Explored range of programming every Saturday on Premier Christian Radio. Don't forget, we've got some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme. See what you've been saying about recent and indeed older shows. So do expect that towards the end of today's show. But today we're talking with Callum Miller, a young apologist and philosopher, actually training as a medic, but has had a strong interest in philosophy and apologetics. And he's in discussion today with James Croft, who is training as a leader of an ethical culture society in St. Louis. And he was telling us about that towards the beginning of today's show. But we've been talking about whether Callum's view that many aspects of the universe, life, the regularity of nature and so on, provide evidence for the existence of God, that we would expect to see those things in a theistic, if you like, universe. And they would be odd to find in a non-theistic universe. That's kind of the way this argument works, in a way. It's a sort of the idea of what are the probabilities, I suppose, of these things occurring in each situation. You've taken issue, James, already with whether science, the laws of nature are that intelligible, whether we discover these things or whether rather it's us kind of imposing our kind of sort of perception on these things and so on. Disagreeing with Paul Davies on that front as well as Callum. But in that last section, you know, Callum's saying this applies to our moral abilities. If there wasn't this regularity that we would expect, our ability to reason, I suppose, in that sense, because through evidence and so on, then we wouldn't be able to act for good or ill, I suppose, in given situations and that kind of thing. And you were looking very quizzical at that point. What's your
yes? That argument here confuses me a bit. So just to kind of get up to where we are up to, I think we started at the beginning with an assertion that science is a process of discovering fundamental truths, and the existence of these fundamental truths is somehow evidence that the universe was created with some orderliness in mind and would be surprising under an atheistic worldview. It feels like we've moved away from that claim. I felt like I heard a concession that, in fact, it's not actually very necessary to think about science in that way, and we certainly didn't have a defense of that position. And we've moved on to a slightly different argument, which is fine, but I would like to note that the initial argument with which we began seems to have been defeated, or at least has a conflict raiser has not been answered. It sounds like this new argument about morality is not really about morality at all. It's just a particular way of framing an argument about the so-called regularity of the universe, and that the argument, I suppose, is that our moral judgments are not possible to make absent some regularity in the universe, some way of determining how our actions will affect other people in a regular way. And I accept that. It will be very difficult to make genuine moral judgments if, for example, the result of everything that we did had a random outcome.
Yeah,
that would be very difficult to understand how morality or ethics could exist within that framework. What I don't understand is the grounds for believing that regularity is unexpected given a non-theistic worldview. I haven't heard any defense of that position. So can you say why you think that?
And then maybe we can return to the issue that James thinks sort of went undefended as well. But yes, let's start here.
Sure. So I think this is something which isn't kind of a particularly niche, or I'm not kind of the only person in the world who thinks it, and certainly there are a lot of people who think that the regularity in the world is an odd thing. And there are a lot of atheist philosophers who say, some of them even say, you know, if it wasn't God who did it, then, you know, what could it be? Why is the universe so regular? And they just dismiss God as an explanation out of hand. Yeah. But they still think, even given that kind of dismissal, there's something to be explained. And I think this basically is part of the general, what's called in the philosophy of science, problem of induction. Mm. And this was kind of originally talked about centuries and centuries ago, but then it was kind of popularized by a philosopher called David Hume a few centuries ago. And Hume basically noted that we don't really have any non-circular justification for thinking that the universe will be regular, or that it will continue to be regular in the future.
All we're going on is our past experience that the sun rises. We've got nothing, there's nothing logically that says that therefore it has to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, and also I think he's even more sceptical in that he doesn't just say, you know, we have to be a bit unsure that the sun will rise tomorrow. He says we actually have no good reason at all for thinking that the sun will rise tomorrow. Because I think the most common justification for thinking that the sun will rise tomorrow is that it's risen every day in the past. But then if you compare two theories, one says the sun rises every day in the past and in the future, and the other theory says the sun rises in the past every day but won't rise tomorrow. Both those theories predict the observations we already have. Mm-hmm. Both those theories kind of lead us to expect the observations, and so the observations we currently have don't distinguish between those two theories.
Okay.
And yet one of those theories predicts that the sun will rise tomorrow, and one of those theories predicts that the sun won't rise tomorrow. And so even though we have those observations, they don't really do any obviously good job of, you know, determining which of these theories is true, and therefore they don't do any obviously good job of determining whether the sun will rise tomorrow or whether it won't. And so that's kind of what Hume is getting at. And he's kind of showing that the past observations that the sun has risen don't really give us that good reason for thinking that it will rise again tomorrow. And there are kind of a lot more technical ways of talking about the problem of induction and giving it. But I mean, this problem is a thing that has kind of perplexed philosophers for centuries. And a lot of them will still admit now that they don't have a very good response to it. I don't have time now, obviously, to defend it in great detail.
No.
But that's the kind of the gist of what I'm getting
at. And where does this lead us? Does this lead us then to the idea that, well, given that we don't have any good reason in that sense to believe that these regularities we observe will continue in the future, that the only reason we could have faith that that will occur is if there is a God who then you would expect such regularities to occur because it would be within the nature of such a God to create a universe in which regularities occur. If there is no God behind the universe, then you've actually got no reason to think that these regularities will continue to occur. You've only got a reason to think that if there is a God in the equation, as it were. Is that kind of the boiled down 2-minute version?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I'm personally still not sure about how exactly the argument goes on from that point, whether I say, you know, all of us rely on assumptions in the end. Relying on God as an assumption is kind of just as reasonable as relying on the idea of induction and the success of science. Or whether it's completely different, whether I just say the success of science is just a given, like we have to accept induction as a kind of foundational belief. It's just kind of a principle we can't go without. But one worldview, atheism, doesn't really explain it, whereas another worldview, theism, does explain it well.
Okay. So the fact that we use induction all the time to predict what will happen is best explained on a theistic worldview because of that than atheism, where you wouldn't have any reason to expect such a thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, so I think the details kind of I still haven't worked out, but that's kind of the gist of it.
Okay. There you go. Okay. That's the gist of it.
So I'm going to make a similar argumentative move as I made when we were talking purely about science and say we do not need to make the assumption of induction. That is not an assumption we need to make to pursue our purposes as human beings. We do not need to assume that the sun is actually going to rise tomorrow or that the outcomes of our actions are going to be as they were in the past. In fact, that would be a disastrous assumption in the moral arena. All we need to do is continue to act in the way that we think is best, given our past experience, without assuming that the future is necessarily going to be like the past. The assumption of induction is not necessary to achieve scientific understanding or moral ends. So I actually don't see how it's very relevant to the argument you're making. Because also, I still didn't hear a defense of the idea that a non-theistic universe could not generate regularity. I hear that you say that repeatedly. I didn't hear a defense of why that is so. It seems to me that we could hypothesize many ways in which a non-theistic universe could generate regularity. The hypothesis of natural laws is one of them, which we began with. I also, interestingly, didn't hear any defense, and I think I never hear a defense of this in these arguments, of how the theistic explanation is actually an explanation. I mean, what explanatory power it actually has. So, for instance, if I asked a question like, how is it that God ensures regularity in the universe? I don't know that you would be able to give me an example that was supported by any evidence. And I feel like if you were able to give me an answer to that question supported by evidence, that would be indistinguishable from a naturalistic explanation. And so I really don't hear any challenge to the non-theistic worldview in any of these arguments. I think we can avoid making an assumption that the future will be like the past. I think that we can... I don't see any defense of the idea that an atheistic world would more likely be non-regular than not. I don't hear why. Okay. Why we
well let's tackle a couple of those. Any reason why you wouldn't expect an atheistic world universe to be regular? Why you know, can you defend that, for instance, Callum?
Sure. So I think maybe one helpful way to think about it is in terms of an analogy. So kind of the more technical, or at least a more technical way of putting this premise is to say that the probability of the world being regular in this particular way is low given atheism.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about probability, we typically, the way we think about probabilities and come up with kind of rough estimates of probabilities is to say, well, how many kind of possible cases are there where so if you say that kind of the probability of X given Y, we want to know how many possible cases are there where X is the case,
mm-hmm.
Out of how many possible cases are there in total.
Okay.
And so what we want to say here is, you know, how many possible, given atheism, given all the possible universes with no God, how many of those possible universes have kind of relevantly regular laws? How many of those are like sufficiently ordered universes that we can act morally and have moral responsibility? And so here, I guess what I'd want to do if I was giving the argument would be to say that there are such a huge number of possible universes given atheism, and so many of them.
How do you know that?
How do I know?
How do you know that there are a huge number of possible universes given atheism?
So,
because it's not accepted by many cosmologists.
So,
Sean Carroll, for instance, says that the probability of a life-sustaining universe is one. Lawrence Krauss is coming to that position as well. That is not an accepted position among cosmologists because we don't know really very much about how universes are created. And in order to generate possibilities, probabilities for things like this, we need to know about the mechanism by which, you know, what sort of dice we're rolling. If we don't know the mechanism by which universes are created, we don't have a basis to establish probabilities.
Yeah, so I think it's important here to establish which kind of possibility we're dealing with. So I think when those cosmologists speak in mind, they talk about physical possibility and all the kind of universes that are physically possible. But that assumes kind of that we're only talking about universes with a particular kind of framework to begin with. Whereas I'm talking more about what philosophers would call epistemically possible worlds, which are basically any world, any kind of way for all we know that things could be. And so this would include universes where unicorns are insects, for example.
Okay.
You know, I don't know if that's physically possible. I don't know if it's possible in some other ways. But for all I know, it could be correct. I don't have certain proof that it's not the case. And so a universe where unicorns are insects is an epistemically possible universe. And I think that's what we have to appeal to here. But just to briefly talk about the kind of mechanism problem. Sure. And so the mechanism is obviously relevant. And if we know about the mechanisms by which universes are created, that will affect certain probabilities. But I think in a lot of cases, we talk about probabilities and come up with probabilities even when we don't know much about a mechanism generating the outcomes.
Can you give an example of when we do that and it's an epistemically respectable practice?
I was just about to.
Excellent. So, thank you.
So one way to think about this would be if someone showed you two coins and one of them was kind of had heads on both sides and one of them had tails on both sides. Now, in the normal case, someone would just have one coin with heads on one side and tails on one side. And we know about the mechanism of the coin. We know it's a fair coin and we know that the probability of it being heads is half and tails is half. But suppose he gave you these two coins, one of which has heads on both sides and the other which has tails on both sides. And he doesn't tell you which of those coins he's using. And he flips it behind, he just takes one of them and flips it behind his back. Even though you don't know which coin he's using, you don't know which kind of what the mechanism of the coin flipping is. You don't know which kind of coin he's working with in the first place. The probability that he's flipped a heads is still a half to you because for all you know, you have to, you know, for all you know, both are equally possible and they're both epistemic possibilities for you.
Right, but to make that probability judgment, you need to know a lot about the total situation. You need to know that there are two and only two coins. You need to know that one coin has two tail sides and one coin has two head sides, which enables you to make, and you have to make all the same basic assumptions about coin flipping and aerodynamics and everything else that goes into assigning probabilities here. And then you can make a very good judgment that it's 50 chance heads and 50 chance tails, knowing all that. So you know everything relevant about the mechanism in order to generate a probability there. When it comes to the assigning probabilities to an atheistic universe turning out regular in certain specific ways, or a theistic universe turning out regular in certain ways. The problem is we actually don't know enough about the mechanisms of either hypothesis to assign probabilities. We need to know enough about both to assign probabilities. We don't really know how universes are created in an atheistic account, so we can't really assign great probabilities on that side. We know nothing about how universes are created on a theistic account, so we can't assign any probabilities there with any justification, because you would need a whole set of prior assumptions about gods, and the existence of a god would have to be a prior assumption in order to assign a probability that a god would create a universe, because the probability is not, you know, you can't assign any probability if you don't know there's a god there to create it yet. And then you have to know something a lot about the psychology of a god and how many universes they might be likely to create and what universes they're likely to create. And we don't know any of that. In fact, there's a fundamental problem with inferences to design in the theistic arena is that they can't stand alone as arguments for God's existence, because inferences to design are only valid when you know that there are designing agents that are capable of bringing about the phenomenon you're trying to explain by design. I can't think of any example where it would be legitimate to infer to design of an entity that we don't even know exists or anything like it. I actually don't think that's a workable argumentative strategy at all.
Okay, responses to some of that then, Callum. I mean, firstly, can you, on what basis are you going with the view, A, that it's likely that if there is a god, the universe that god would produce would be one that we witness of regular laws and so on? And again, back to this question of have you got any reason why on an atheist account it would be unlikely to see such a universe, given what James has said about, well, we just don't know about how universe is created, so we can't say anything about that at this point.
Sure. So in general, we don't need to know that a hypothesis is true or false before we assess the probability of some outcome given that hypothesis.
Right.
Mm. So, for example, say I take a scientific theory and we'll just call it T. T is either true or false. And the probability of me getting some data, I don't need to know whether T is true or false in order to assess the probability of getting some particular data given T.
Mm-hmm.
And because I need to get that anyway, and I need to get the probability of getting that data if T is false as well in order to see whether the data supports that theory or not. That's just kind of how probability works in science. Mm. And so in general, we don't need to assume the truth of a theory to come up with those kinds of probabilities.
Right.
Now, there's obviously a very difficult question about how we get those probabilities and how precise they can be. And I'm not making any claim about whether we can, with, you know, very good precision, say what's the probability of an ordered universe given theism. But I think a lot of times in science, scientists come up with less specific theories. So some theories in science are very specific and others are quite vague.
Mm.
So the theory of common descent doesn't make any kind of statistical claims. You know, the probability of us finding a particular genetic pattern given Darwinism isn't a particularly well-defined probability.
Okay.
And a lot of biologists would agree with that.
Mm.
And even more so the probability of us finding that genetic pattern if Darwinism wasn't true. So in both cases, we don't know a huge amount about, you know, what's the exact probability of getting that genetic pattern, that evidence, given Darwinism and given the falsehood of Darwinism. But we can still, I think, come up with some ballpark figures just thinking about, you know, how roughly does Darwinism work?
Yeah. Right.
And the same would apply to the God issue then, presumably.
I think so, yeah. So I don't think, you know, theism is kind of a really well-circumscribed mathematical theory. But I think we can kind of have rough ideas. And I think a lot of atheists would implicitly accept this. So one useful way to think about it might be to say, well, a lot of atheists say that the probability of there being so much suffering of this kind in the world, given theism, is very low.
Mm.
And atheists often use that as an argument against God. And I think they're right to. And that's because we don't necessarily need to know about God's mechanisms in great detail or about the mechanisms involved in atheism in great detail to come up with rough estimates for that kind of thing.
And so you kind of then ascribe certain probabilities, these ballpark figures, let's say, to God, because your view is that it makes sense to you that if there is a God, that God would create a universe in which there are law-like regularities and so on. Is that because you've got a definition of God that you're kind of working off, essentially, from your assumption about the nature of God is such that there wouldn't be much interest for that God in creating universes which don't follow any law-like regularities kind of thing? It would make sense for that God to, by the nature of a God, if we're defining God as loving, all-knowing, the kind of classical definition, this is the kind of universe you would expect to find. Is that kind of where you're
going? Yeah, so I think you do have to flesh it out a little bit. You have to say that it's kind of a good God who wants to bring about good states of affairs and good things in the world. And if you say that, and then if we have knowledge that kind of moral responsibility can be a good thing, then I wouldn't want to say that a regular universe is very probable given theism. But I'd want to say it's not as surprising given theism, even that, you know, it might not be hugely probable, but given how surprising I think the regularity would be given atheism, if it's less surprising given theism, then that counts.
But here's the other thing. James is saying it's not surprising given atheism, right? as far as you're concerned.
At least I would say I haven't heard a reason to consider it surprising given atheism. And I think there's two things to say here. I think, firstly, I agree with Callum. You do not have to assume that the truth of a scientific theory in order to assess whether evidence related to that theory makes the hypothesis more or less likely to be true.
So the same can apply to the God hypothesis.
No. This is why you can't make that maneuver, because Callum is not advancing a scientific hypothesis here. He is advancing an inference to design, and that is not a scientific hypothesis. A scientific hypothesis presents a mechanism by which something can occur, which we then investigate to see whether we have evidence that that mechanism actually occurred. An inference to design is an appeal to an agent. It's not a mechanism. There is no scientific hypothesis here. It's merely saying, is it more likely that an agent of a particular type would create, through whatever mechanism, this state of affairs? Is that more likely than not? So we're not actually investigating evidence for or against a scientific hypothesis. We're investigating evidence for or against an inference to design. And that is a different epistemic process, and it requires different sorts of conditions in order to get it off the ground. And one of the challenging conditions is that it really is only reasonable. I can't think of a single incidence where you would want to make an inference to design where we didn't independently have reasons to assume the existence of a relevant agency that could could do the design. Like, for instance, you know, we can go to a crime scene and ask, was this an accidental death or was it a murder? Because we have antecedent reasons to believe that there are creatures that regularly commit murders. Mm. That is an essential part of the design inference in that situation. Likewise, we could go to a strange and distant planet and find objects that seem to be evidence of some sort of intelligent agency, because we know that intelligent organisms exist in the universe and are at least in principle capable of existing elsewhere in the universe. Absent that knowledge, an inference to design would be very risky. And that's within the boundaries of this universe, let alone outside the boundaries in the area of creating a universe. All so right, there are differences between a scientific hypothesis and an inference to design, which are very relevant here.
We're going to have to take another break, and then we've got 10, 15 minutes. We'll stretch it a bit to keep the conversation going and have some response.
I could do this all day.
We'll have to have a round two, evidently. But talking about whether God is the best explanation for the way we perceive the universe, and a really good and well thought out debate going on here in the studio between Callum Miller, my Christian guest, and James Croft, my atheist guest today. I'm Justin Brierley, and I'll be back with the third part of today's edition of Unbelievable. Certainly helping to get the grey matter going this Saturday afternoon, and I hope you can join us again in a couple of minutes' time. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Brierley, your host today. And don't forget that later on you can hear The Profile as well. Another well-known Christian in some area of faith and life will be talking about their journey of faith. That's between 4 and 5 today, part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon. Faith Explored is also a segment in Premier Christianity magazine, which I edit. So if you're interested in the kinds of issues we're debating today, but indeed all kinds of issues in terms of objections objections to Christianity, other worldviews and so on, then do go and check it out. You can get a free copy by going to the website premierchristianity.com look for the free sample there. Don't forget this programme available online as well via the website of Unbelievable, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Next week on the programme, we're going to be hearing a conversation I had with a very eminent person, Graham Ward, the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University. Happens to share the same surname as his predecessor, Keith Ward. But we're talking about a recent book. He's literally hot off the press this summer, called Unbelievable, funnily enough. And it's all about the psychology and biology of believing and not believing. Fascinating discussion I'm going to be having with him next week at the same time, if you can come back. So that's what to look out for next week on the podcast or here on the radio on Saturday afternoon. But before we get to some of your feedback in a little bit of time here on the programme, we're going to continue and finish off this this discussion, which it feels like we've only really just got into in many ways on the whether God is the best explanation for the universe and everything. It's called the argument from induction, and I'll just remind you where we got up to as we approach the third part of this discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Yes, and the guests who are discussing this, Callum Miller, a young apologist. He's actually a medic in training, but he's had a strong interest in philosophy, which he's been able to pursue at Oxford University. And you can tell that from the way he structures his arguments and thinks through things. Definitely a philosopher here in our midst, but also someone with a philosophical background is James Croft, who, as I've mentioned, is very much part of the humanist scene, especially in the States. He's an ethical culture leader in training at the Ethical Society of St. Louis. And you guys have been having a really interesting to and fro. So many areas that we've only been able to glancingly touch on and would be fascinating to continue to discuss. But just in that last section there, James, you particularly challenged Callum with just the whole idea that you don't feel, again, that there's been God would be an explanation of any kind. It's certainly not in the nature of a scientific hypothesis, because it's an argument from inference, essentially, to an agent, and we've got no concept of this agent even to start with, if you like, and that sort of thing. So, picking up from where we left off, there, Callum, any thoughts you wanted to bring to this as we start to draw things together?
Yeah, sure. So, one or two things, I guess. The first is that there seems to be a problem in that we don't really have a mechanism for how God does things, how He brings about certain states of affairs in the world. And it doesn't seem to me that this is necessarily so much of a problem, in that in a lot of kind of scientific investigation, we don't know a mechanism by how something works. And we sometimes don't even think we could investigate it at any point in the future, or maybe very distantly in the future. But at some point in any kind of scientific explanation of the world, there will be basic causation. There will be things without a mechanism. So, for example, kind of the force of gravity, there's a little bit of debate about kind of whether it does things by causing a curve in space-time, for example. I won't go into detail in that. But
please don't.
I won't. But kind of at root, there will be a kind of basic force that there isn't a mechanism, or a different kind of force, an electromagnetic force, which we don't have any mechanism really about
so
how
at
it
this
works.
Point, we There's don't have a mechanism, but we kind of assume there is this thing going on called gravity.
So it might be that there is a mechanism. It might be that that just is the most basic, primitive mechanism there is. But we seem to be okay talking about these causes. We can say this happened because of the electromagnetic force or because of the force of gravity. And we don't need to say much detail about how that works as a mechanism.
So we don't need to explain the mechanism in order to say it happened because of this thing.
Yeah, and so similarly with God, I think we don't necessarily have to have a mechanism for how God works in order to say, you know, to
say that that is still the best explanation of this thing. I mean, I don't know whether to move this on and sort of maybe get us to the point of again, addressing, well, in a godless universe, again, James's contention is you haven't given me any reason, Callum, to think that we wouldn't expect to see this the type of universe we do encounter, because you talked about hypothetical possible worlds, you know, and so on. But the fact is, we're living in, you know, a universe that was produced by some kind of a cause, which, for all we know, could produce only intelligible universes and so on. So do you feel like you've kind of properly addressed that at this point, this idea of whether on atheism we wouldn't expect to see this kind of universe?
I definitely don't think I've addressed it in, you know, as much detail as I could. But I also don't really want to address it in as much detail as I could. And I suspect no one else wants me to either. But I mean, just I guess kind of a couple things I point to. One is that it is kind of the more broad problem of induction in the philosophy of science. And a lot of philosophers, Christian, non-Christian and so on, are agreed, not everyone, a lot of people think it can be solved, but a lot of people are agreed that we don't really have any good reason, kind of theism bracketed for a moment, we don't have any good reason to think that the world will continue to be regular in the same ways or in the relevant ways. But
I mean, one thing that you said, James, is that but you don't think we do exist on this principle that the world will continue to be regular.
I actually think a lot more is made of the problem of induction than needs to be made of it. I don't see it as a philosophical or practical problem at all. I don't think that we need to make the assumption that our future experience is going to be like our past experience.
But surely we do if we're predicting where, you know, the planets will be at this time next year.
Well, okay.
We need to go on the basis that everything will proceed in the same regular fashion it has in the past. Right.
So that statement is a very interesting one, because there was a time before we knew what the regular movement, the so-called regular movements of the planets were, and there were all sorts of theories about them which turned out to be wrong. So people were predicting on the basis of what they thought the planets were going to do, and it turned out they were wrong, and they modified their theories. So it's not unusual that we experience things that are not in line with our expectations of how the future will go. So this idea that there is this unproblematic regularity to our experience, which sort of undergirds everything, I think is a construction. I think that we have got to the point where we understand that there are many things that stay the same, seem to stay the same. Mm-hmm. But there are tons of things that are not the same day to day as well, and we separate them out as we go along. I don't see...
The only way we could work out the difference between those things is if there are regularities that we kind of assume. I mean,
well, that we experience.
That we
don't assume them. We experience them, and we make.
And don't we make all our decisions on the basis, though, that we will continue to experience?
It would be very problematic if certain things that have previously stayed the same started to change. But I don't think that would pose some massive problem, sort of epistemic or meta-epistemic problem. We would just have to construct different models of what things stay the same and what things don't. If, for example, tomorrow the sun did not rise, we would be very shocked.
Yes.
And we would have to come up with a different explanation about how things work.
Right.
But we have been shocked before by observations, and we have come up with different ways of. So I don't think it would be an enormous problem. Total randomness would be a huge problem. But I don't think challenges. I just don't actually see it as a huge philosophical problem in the way that other people do. But it might be because I take a very unusual philosophical approach, which is not shared by most philosophers, but which I think is the most defensible one. But it would take a long time to explain that.
I mean, from your perspective, you presumably do believe that induction is a natural sort of standpoint to take in a way of understanding the world, Callum.
And intriguingly, you also believe that there's no reason to believe that. Except maybe God.
Except if there is a God. The best explanation for our belief in induction is if there is a God.
That is clearly not true. The best explanation for our belief in induction would be something like it's an extraordinarily adaptive belief to hold, which is very useful to us. Right. And that, I mean, that's another problem in this discussion.
Maybe that's a different thing. Explanation for the belief. But the explanation for induction, as I understand it, Callum, is for you God is a better explanation than a godless universe for the nature of induction.
Yeah.
So let's explore how we might, if we really take this problem seriously, let's see if I can come up with a convincing way of looking at this in a non-theistic universe. I take it that you accept that we're evolved organisms.
Yeah.
We're animals. We evolved in certain conditions, certain cognitive capacities. Now, it seems to me clearly adaptive for an organism to evolve cognitive capacities, which makes it possible for them to discern regularities in their experience such that they can plan for the future based on those regularities. That seems to me very clearly adaptive. If we can't make sense of our experience and therefore plan for what we think is going to be our future, we're going to do much worse than an organism very much like us, but that can do that.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me sufficient explanation for why human beings have the capability of constructing mental models which posit regularities in order to help us plan for the future. And it doesn't seem to me you need any more explanation than that in an atheistic universe. It is adaptive.
Okay.
For organisms to be able to engage in that activity.
There's a reason then, Callum, why we do...
I think that solves this so-called problem of intelligibility. The universe is intelligible to the extent that it seems to be intelligible because it is adaptive, evolutionary, for us to be able to make sense of our experience.
Okay. Has this solved your 2 years of research or whatever you've been doing?
So ironically, I actually have kind of a very technical version of this argument in front of me. I've written a paper on it, which I'm going to give to James after, and we can talk about
sweet.
It more. And one of the objections I talk about here is the evolution one, kind of the explanation for why our way of thinking about the world fits the world so accurately is because it's adaptively beneficial.
Okay, but let's later finish that. Yeah.
And so I don't have time kind of to
lay it out,
do it perfect justice.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes.
Okay, but there are kind of three brief things which I want to at least touch on.
Okay.
The first is that it's not necessarily that clear that evolution selects for true beliefs. So Alvin Plantinga gives a famous example where he talks about a tiger and Paul. And he says, well, there are many ways that Paul can do the evolutionary kind of the evolutionarily beneficial action. Mm. He can think that the tiger is dangerous and run away from it. Or he can think that the tiger wants to play and that the best way to play with it is to run away from it.
Mm.
Only one of those selects for true belief. And only one of those is kind of reliable in terms of generating kind of truth about the world.
But they're both adaptive.
They're both adaptive, and evolution doesn't necessarily select for those.
Sure. Okay.
The second is that even if evolution so far has selected for us having good inductive criteria, even if so far evolution has kind of matched our kind of reasoning to the way the world actually is, there's no guarantee that it will do so in the future.
Mm.
So if the world completely changed tomorrow, if the sun didn't rise, if emeralds became blue and things like that, evolution wouldn't have helped us, you know, select for that. And so evolution doesn't give us any guarantee that the world will continue to be regular. Mm. And thirdly, I think if we want to use evolution as an explanation for why our kind of preferences and reasoning matches the world, I think we have to have a good reason to believe in evolution in the first place.
Mm.
Now, I think we do, but I think the reasoning we have for believing in evolution depends itself on induction.
Yeah.
And so it kind of already assumes exactly.
Yeah, sure.
Like I say, I could say more, but I won't for now.
You've already said plenty there. And I am going to have to start to draw this to a close, as much as we've opened up a whole new can of worms that we could debate all day. But I mean...
Can I have 30 seconds to offer a thought?
30 seconds for a thought, and then we'll do closings.
So I think the problem with that way of thinking about things is this idea that our beliefs are true, our cognitive capacities are truth conducive. I think the problem is in the fundamental understanding of what truth is. Our ideas do not match a truth that is out there in the world. Our ideas enable us to function in ways that help us solve our problems. And once you take a pragmatic view of, quotes, truth, this distinction completely vanishes. There is no way in which a valuable cognitive mechanism that makes sense of our experience could simultaneously be untrue. I just don't I don't accept Plantinga's idea of what truth is. And so...
I'm tempted to ask you, and do you believe that's true? I mean, sense that...
No, I don't believe it's true. I believe that it is a useful way of thinking.
So in that sense, then, everything we're saying is just an adaptive kind of response to your environment.
Yes, that is what science is. That is what philosophy is. It is an attempt to clarify thinking to solve human problems. It is not an attempt to get at some transcendent truth, or even, I would say, some actual truth that exists in, quote, the world. I think the idea of a world separate to our experience is not necessarily a very helpful one. Well, okay, the idea is a helpful one, but to assert that it's true is not particularly helpful.
I suppose as I start to draw this to a close, Callum, what we've got here is not just a difference in view about God, but the difference in view about the nature of reality, where you are perfectly willing to see that we... interact with a world in which there is an objective realm of true things and an objective realm of scientific laws and principles that we're discovering and all the rest of it. Whereas James just says, I just don't think it's like that at all. We're kind of just mapping from our experience onto this universe all this stuff. And we don't actually have a clue really whether there is such an objective universe out there, you know, in that sense. So, as usual, we've just got two very different perspectives in the programme. But anything you want to say as we close out the programme?
I guess kind of on that last point, it's kind of similar to most arguments in that there'll always be someone who disagrees with one of the premises. And I think most people probably would. I mean, as James said, his view is somewhat unusual. And I think most people would accept that there is some kind of order, there is truth about the world and so on. And so I think the argument can still have sway for those. And in terms of when I talk with people who believe what James believes, you'll then have to go into greater detail and do more work in showing that the premises are true in the first place. But I think that can be done.
Okay.
But in terms of, I guess, just concluding very briefly, I guess it's probably worth just summing up the premises in the argument and roughly where we got to them. Okay. So the first was that there is order. Like I say, James disagrees to some extent. I think most people would agree, but I think there is at least some basic kind of order that we need for moral action and responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I said that this was relatively improbable given atheism, and that's because there are so many kind of possible atheistic worlds where there's just complete chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And patterns generally are unusual, and it's such a coincidence that there's a kind of regularity that this seems to be improbable, given that atheism doesn't provide us with any more resources to make it probable. And finally, I said that the regularity is more probable given theism, and that's because we need regularity to act morally in the world. And if theism is true, then there is a good God who wants to bring about moral responsibility. And so it's not terribly surprising that there would be a reasonably regular universe.
Sure.
And so that's all I'd like to
say. There you go. That's the short version of the hour-long conversation. James, just a final word as we close up from you.
Wow, that's my final word. We explored a lot of things. I think that all I would say is that thinking about all those three premises, apart from the first one where I think that there's a lot that we might say about what this order consists of and how it's best to understand it, I think that it would be fair to say that I haven't heard a justification of either of the two planks of the argument, either that order is less likely on an atheistic worldview, and I don't think we ever got to a place where we really heard an argument as to why we should actually believe that to be true, and that order is more likely on a theistic account, I think requires a lot more work than we are able to do today. But all these arguments are way more than you can get into in such a short program.
Of course, and we've stretched the boundaries a bit, so we'll have a slightly curtailed feedback section anyway in today's program. But it's been great fun. Maybe we could do this again at some point.
Yeah.
And stretch the grey matter again. But very interesting. Thank you, Callum. Do make sure to keep us abreast of other things that you're working on. And we look forward to seeing you again at some point down the line.
Yeah, thanks very much to both of you. I really enjoyed it today. Hope you can do it again.
Yeah, I totally will fly back again anytime.
If you want to find out more about Callum, callumsblog.com is where he posts his thoughts and musings and philosophical arguments. Temple of the Future is the name of James's blog, available via the Pathos website network or just at templeofthefuture.net. So thanks again, guys, for being on the programme today. And if you want to get in touch or indeed listen back to today's programme, share it with others, why not check it out at the Unbelievable website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Just time for a short burst of your thoughts and feedback on today's programme. In just a moment's time, you're listening to Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, let's go to some of your feedback just quickly. We've just about got some time to squeeze some in. Just a quick reminder, though, if you are interested in philosophy, theology and that kind of thing, if you've listened to today's programme, it's the kind of thing that really floats your boat, then you might be interested in the Unbelievable Conference DVD and MP3 CD, available now to pre-order, and it's going to be hitting doormats very soon. So if you want to get hold of that, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. Over 13 hours of audio and video from this year's conference held here in London with a range of speakers including William Lane Craig, Oz Guinness, people from the UK and the US, Craig Hazen, Clay Jones, Jeff Zwierink, who were partners with us from Biola and RTB, and of course from here in the UK, people like David Robertson, Ruth Jackson, Jay Smith. And we had special guest Tim McGrew joining us as well, of course. And so loads of subjects discussed, really great times of Q&A, feedback and times for networking and so on. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable DVD if you want to order your copy. It plays anywhere in the world, so no problem if you're abroad in the US somewhere. That's not a problem. OK, let's go to some of your feedback. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you want to get in touch about today's show, and I'll give you the ways to get in touch via social media shortly too. Chris J over in Atlanta says, I'd prefer not to be counted among the atheists who are critical of your show and find it overly biased. Rather, count me as an atheist who finds your show to be a shining example of how one can accommodate a wide variety of viewpoints while remaining fair and respectful to all of those. I must offer your gratitude for your willingness to allow those who have views with which you differ a forum to be heard, and for even-tempered moderation and concern for respect. Few other shows from any perspective are so fair to other viewpoints. I've noted your willingness to even challenge other Christians at times. You're doing a fine job. Please keep doing that. So carry on as normal, says Chris. Thank you very much, Chris. It's been lovely, actually, after I did read a couple of critical emails a few weeks ago, to have some emails coming in from people saying, I disagree, I think it's okay. So thank you very much. Very nice to hear from you. Peter gets in touch about that show again a few weeks ago now, on the Unbelievers movie. Gus Holwerder, the director and producer of the movie, which features Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss on a world tour, was in conversation with our Christian guest Graham Veal, talking about science and faith and the sort of, I don't know, the cult of some of these atheist figures, big figures. And Peter says, excellent show. There is so much I could say, so I'm going to narrow it down to three standout points. That's what we like, Peter. Always a good email when you've got three short points. One, it was interesting how your Christian guests seem to be more versed in the academic and historical harmony between religion and science, whereas the atheist guests seem to appeal more to his experience of how lay people, especially church lay people, understand that there's a conflict between the two. What intellectual warnings, consequently, ought both atheists and Christians take from this? Secondly, on the issue of atheists needing to feign faith in order to be accepted in American politics, doesn't Dawkins realise what he's saying? If he's going to say that atheists need to lie about believing in God in order to get into government, then he's ultimately saying that Congress, etc., is full of hypocritical atheists. How does it help to advance the cause of atheism by saying that atheists will tell lies about their beliefs in order to get your vote? Sounds rather unprincipled. And thirdly, there was much discussion as to whether Dawkins and Krauss have become the rock stars of atheism, but since when has rock stardom been a credible basis to treat somebody as an authority on matters of truth? Fundamentally, what matters is whether or not Dawkins and Krauss are thinking clearly and critically. Yet the producer of this movie didn't seem to treat that as a priority. Much was made of the eloquence and poetry of their writings, but what worth is that if the ideas they advocate and communicate are fundamentally fallacious? Yet again, a classic example of how philosophical integrity is being sacrificed on the altar of popular entertainment. That's a lovely flourish there at the end, Peter, but thank you very much. Ed Atkinson, I didn't get a chance to read this one last week, but I thought I'd dig it out again for this. Ed was a guest a couple of months ago now with Oz Guinness. It was Oz Guinness and the ex-Christian, Ed being the ex-Christian. And I read out a couple of to-and-fro emails since then. Here's another one, though. So last time I read an email from Ed, it was about whether we could sort of look at the question of whether science or religion tell us what's wrong with the world. I responded to that and you said, however, in your response, I felt you missed the impact of the key point. My point is that the fall is in conflict with science, and you helpfully confirmed that this applies for all common interpretations of the Genesis account. It's here that I want you to stop and consider. The fall is the foundational concept of the key doctrine in Christianity, salvation from our sin. But the fall is denied by science. If we go with science, there's no need for the cross. Your response that science does not itself give an explanation of what is wrong with the world is completely fair, but it doesn't address the point, and nor does the material covered in the show you recommended between Jeff Lillis and Andrew Wilson. Anyway, you've gone through and say you haven't found much that directly addresses this. I think I understand your criticism there, Ed, that you feel that science tells you, as it were, what's gone wrong with the world in terms of giving a physical explanation for why there is sickness and death and that kind of thing in the world. And in a sense, yes, I'd agree. Science does give an explanation of that in terms of a physical explanation of how genes work and what happens when they get corrupted and cancer happens and that kind of thing. But it doesn't, as it were, I think, ultimately answer the question of why it matters, as it were. I think that's not a scientific question. And that was, I suppose, the point I was trying to make when I responded to your question. In the end, if there is a sense that this is wrong, in some sense, you know, ultimately wrong, if we're at some sense at odds with the idea of death, if we're living somehow in a world which is alien to us because death is something which, you know, causes this grief, there's that sense that we're somehow living in a world that's out of kilter with how it should be. That's the way I see it. And I do see the Christian explanation of the fall as parsimonious with the way we understand life and death and the reality of evil and that kind of thing. I don't think science ultimately gives us that kind of an explanation. That was the point I was trying to make. I appreciate, though, that it's hard to do that in a to and fro on an email and radio show. But thank you for getting in touch. So much more to be said, but we're running out of time. So going to have to call it a day for now. Thank you for joining me on today's programme. Hope you can come back at the same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming up then. You're unbelievable. We're going to be hearing from Graham Ward. No relation to Keith Ward, but he is in fact the holder of the title he used to have. Graham Ward is now the Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University. He's got a new book out. It's called Unbelievable, funnily enough. And it's all about the issue of consciousness and the brain and whether there may be more going on than just physics, biology and neurons. So come back for that. Should be an interesting discussion with him at the same time next week. For now, thank you for being with me here on Premier Christian Radio. But do stick around, because coming up next, it's The Profile.